Waves and seagulls. They are the sounds of the seashore, familiar to millions of people across the ages, across the world and across cultures. There's the unique experience of standing, watching the waves roll over a beach, crash against a jetty, or lap against the side of a boat. Monsignor Paul Donovan is the principal Catholic chaplain to the Royal Navy, and so he has a special connection with the sea.
You can't go onto the immensity of the waters and not be moved by the sight either of the tumult of the waves or the gluttonous of the great expanse of sea as you move, for example, through the Indian Ocean.
But how and why did he come to be a naval chaplain in the first place?
Well, it's a very varied ministry in the Navy, and one of the reasons why I joined the Navy in the first place was after a few years in the parish, the work became very familiar, and I felt a call to do something different while I was still young, and the idea of service chaplaincy began to grow in my mind, because you're working with people you'd never otherwise encounter in parish life, in very different circumstances, and often in circumstances where they've got no other pastoral resources on which they can call. So the idea of doing something which was meeting the needs of those on the margins of our society, doing something for those and being amongst those that, you know, the country expects to look after its borders and to be a force for good in the world, began to grow very much in my mind, and that's the reason why 22 years ago I was allowed by my bishop to go off and to become a naval chaplain.
So does that mean you had to do three lots of training? Training for the priesthood, then ordinary training as a sailor, and then chaplaincy training?
That's right, yes. The Navy and the other armed forces don't accept chaplains until they're already ordained and experienced. So they expect them to have cut their teeth and made their really big mistakes on civilians. So they get a trained product in. But of course you need to be able to learn those things which are necessary for survival in an armed force. And so just like everyone else, we train in sea safety, damage control, firefighting. And probably the most daunting thing we ever do is the training to escape from an upturned and submerged helicopter, because we'll often transfer between units by helicopter. So it's a necessary skill to have tucked in just in case you need it. And then, of course, you need to train up as a chaplain to know how to tailor your skills and your approach to people who, for the most part, aren't going to be church-going Catholics, because if you're chaplain on board the ship, you'll be the only chaplain on board the ship. My last role, for example, I was the chaplain of the aircraft carrier HMS Illustrious, with an air group embarked, about 1,000 people on board. 120 of them would have been Catholic, but I was chaplain to all 1,000. So you need to learn how to be appropriately a chaplain to everybody and not just to the Catholics.
So you'd need to know an awful lot about not only Christianity, but presumably the other religions and non-religions as well.
Yes, the majority, far and away the majority of those in the armed forces put themselves down on their records as being Christians. But we've got people of other world faiths on board. And yes, you're meant to be chaplain to them too. And certainly my experience has been that when I've been in units as the chaplain, they regard, you know, a Muslim or a Hindu or a Sikh would regard the chaplain as their own in the same way as they would a minister of their own faith. And so they do use the chaplain for pastoral care because they recognise that that's what the chaplain is skilled at.
And presumably, if you're on board a ship, even if it's got a large crew, you've got a very tight-knit community because the life of each sailor depends on the others. But it's also, if you're at sea for a long time, it could be a very lonely experience as well.
It certainly produces a sense of great bond amongst people. Every ship has got its own cap tally, and so there's that visible sense of identity to each other. But as you walk around the passageways and as you go in the compartments, people do recognise each other, they become familiar with each other, and there is a real sense that when a ship goes away for a standard deployment will be 6 months, when a ship goes away for 6 months, that we become father and mother and brother and sister and son and daughter to each other, that there's a real bond which grows up. And if, for example, you're in a foreign port and you know, a bit of trouble arises, people do look to protect their own because they've got that real sense of belonging to each other.
And also, presumably, if you're away for 6 months at a time, there's bound to be at least some people on board ship who are going to have babies born in their families or relatives die or be sick at home, and they're a long way from home.
Yes, and we are a microcosm of a community on board ship. And to some extent, being away from Britain means that everything becomes slightly more exaggerated. If, for example, a sailor gets an email from his wife to say that the children have been up at sea in the morning and the washing machine's just broken down, it all seems so much worse the more miles away you are. But we do get sailors whose children are born back in Britain, and generally the service makes great efforts to get fathers back for the birth of their children. But there are also the bereavements, and that's often when people will look to the chaplain to help them round the corner of that particular issue. So the service will often make great strides to get someone back for a funeral. If it's immediate family, it will send them back at public expense. If it's a looser relationship, then people can often use their own leave, but they need to make their way back at their own expense. And if they choose not to, then we'll often do something on board the ship to allow that person to grieve and to mourn that person at the same time as, for example, the funeral is taking place.
But as a chaplain, and especially as a priest, you're a non-combat member of the Navy, and yet your parishioners are all trained for combat. So that must put you in quite a unique position.
Yes, the understanding shared by all the armed forces is that the chaplain and the medical staff are there for all combatants, no matter what uniform they wear. And the chaplain and medical staff aren't combatants themselves, but they minister to whoever needs them, regardless of whether they are friend or foe. And the sailors on board ship would feel uncomfortable if it were any different, I think. There is the sense that they grasp the role of what it is to be a minister of God, and that God is not partisan. And therefore, there is something intrinsic about being a minister in uniform that, to some extent, you rise above your nationality because you're representing not just your country, but you are, you know, God's representative to those people.
And most of your parishioners, being normal human beings, wouldn't be looking for combat situations. So in a way, the possibility of being in a combat situation is asking them to do something that is foreign to their actual personality and their nature. So that in itself would make demands.
Yes, there is that inherent tension, isn't it? That no one looks for conflict, but sometimes find yourself in a position whereby to do what's right, conflict is going to be involved. We've often found ourselves in situations whereby, you know, harm is being done to a people who aren't able to look after themselves, and there's something intrinsic about our sense of what it is to be human beings and what it is to be Christian, to fight for the oppressed. And uncomfortable as it might be, there are people in uniform recognise that that's what's expected of them and that's the right thing to do. I remember once, for example, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Runcie, once reflecting on his own war service. And during the Second World War, he was an officer and not a chaplain. And reflecting on the situation in Germany with the persecution of the Jews, he remarked that even if Germany had not invaded Poland, for which that provided the trigger for the alliances to then fight on behalf of Poland, even if Germany had not invaded Poland, there was still reason enough for the way that the Jewish people were being treated for the other countries of the world to go to their aid. And I think there's still that pervading sense that there will be situations in the world where people are being so oppressed by those above them that there might be a justification at some point for other countries going to their aid.